Like that? Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. I had the microphone backwards this entire time. All right. This is Charged Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Owen Williams. I'm a technology writer at The Next Web, and joining me today is...
I'm John Edgar, Owen's co-host, and I am the CEO and managing director of Stay, a civil engineering firm, and former VP of strategy at DigitalOcean.
Today we're going to talk about some very interesting things. We don't have a lot of topics because they're kind of huge, so I think we should just kind of jump straight in the deep end. So Slack had this like monumental announcement on their two-year anniversary that they already reached 2.3 million users. So last year, like I guess on the first anniversary, they only had 500,000. Holy shit. They're growing like crazy. It's
amazing.
And it's not even, this is daily active users. It's not even like overall users. They haven't even revealed that number. So I'm kind of blown away. I'm amazed that this tool is being used for basically everything. I use it at home already. We use it with like a Wunderlist built in. Me and my girlfriend kind of use Trello in there. It's super nerdy, but it actually works perfectly because like it's just kind of a place to log in and all our stuff is there, right?
I am incredibly, incredibly proud of Stuart. I think he is, someone on Twitter the other day said it best, the CEO that we all want to be. I'm really lucky I got to start using Slack in a tiny little Slack testers thing in mid-2013 with just Stuart and a bunch of...
Oh, really?
Of the,
wow.
Yeah. And on October 23rd, 2013, I messaged Stuart and said, I think you're going to hit it with this one. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, man. Crazy. So you were there right at the start. That's really cool.
Yeah, actually this channel, this Slack testers group is friggin' amazing. When you go back and look through all the features requests and see how we kind of like talk to them about them building it, they were amazing at just like taking all of our feedback, listening to kind of how we thought about things, and really, really rapidly iterating on the product and getting it to kind of where it is today, this like amazing, amazing platform for communication. And I think they're only just getting going. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty much the best software product that's come out in the last 2 or 3 years. And you know,
in a while. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I think like, they really took kind of an old idea and mushed it with another idea, really. Like it's IRC, but like just made so much more accessible. And I think that their thing is really, it's not just a chat tool, right? So they really open up a business. Every business I've gone like worked at that's adopted it suddenly has really gone from like this closed silos thing where to a world where you can actually see what's going on with everybody. So it's kind of interesting what it's doing just beyond chat. It's really cool. I'm kind of bullish on that alone.
It's definitely not a chat tool. I think that's the basically almost like. And like, I think I get a little annoyed when I see people in the press talking about like chat app Slack and stuff. It's like, no, this is definitely a full blown communications platform it abstracts so much of your whole business communication. It's amazing. It's really, really, really good.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see what they do, I guess, over the next kind of 12 months. They've got that kind of collaborative document editing thing kind of that they acquired a little while ago. They've got Screen Hero. I'm kind of excited to start seeing those roll in. I expect it'll just get a lot bigger.
Yeah, I hope he takes it public. I think this company deserves to be in the public market. I think it will fare really well in the public market. And I think that Stuart's actually would be a phenomenal public market CEO. So I hope they take it public
because
it's going to kill.
Out of all the companies that could IPO, I think they would be one of the most interesting ones at the moment. I mean, rather than what's going on in the consumer world. So let's move on to Giphy. They raised another $55 million, the search engine for GIFs, at a $300 million post-money valuation. What do you think of this? I mean, it's monetizing GIFs, but is it more than that?
Well, I think that first, this is like basically one of the most reasonable valuations that I've seen in a while. Like that seems like, you know, 300 mil seems about what this company's worth. And I think that if they can get it into being basically the search engine for GIFs, then, you know, they're in a very good position to see real revenue, and especially from kind of monetizing that search in a similar way to, you know, all the other search engines basically. And ultimately, when you look at GIFs, I mean, they've taken off in a massive way. Like, people love GIFs.
Yeah.
Teenagers love GIFs. Like, if you...
It's amazing the renaissance, right? They've come back out of... they've existed for, what, decades? And then, like, recent... I would say in the last couple of years, they've really returned as, I guess, internet connections and phones and everything have made them, again, more accessible.
1987 was when the... Oh, sorry.
No way.
Yeah. When the graphics interchange format, better known as the GIF, which is a bitmap image format, was introduced by CompuServe.
Wow, yeah, I mean, that's crazy.
Because it's like a little video that's better than a video. It's not an MOV. It's ubiquitous. It plays in every browser. It plays on every device. And it's like, here's this little, like, here's this little, you know, movement thing that, like, you can just have and share quickly. It's cool. It's awesome. It's like, it's just, it's more impactful, I think. I think they're great. I think it's a great company. I'm super bullish on them. Well valued. Got enough runway to get them through the next couple of years, I'd imagine. Can't wait to see what they do.
I've met a few people from there. It's really interesting because if you kind of read the sentiment yesterday about it on Twitter, I know it's really a bubble of social media, but people were like, oh yeah, but they, you know, they're worth $300 million and it's GIFs. And I'm like, no, but you don't understand. These guys are not just doing GIFs. They're actually creating this whole ecosystem. They have, not only do they have Twitter, you know, using them as the GIF provider, their Facebook has integrations, they're actually creating original content, they actually go out and make original GIFs that are in their search engine, they do partnerships with advertisers, like, it's more than just GIFs. And I think it's going to be an interesting company. I think it's a good format, and I've met Adam, I think he's their CTO, and he really sells it well when you talk to this guy. He's like, GIFs communicate everything. It's emotion, it's everything, and you just send one file and that's it. And so I think the valuation is fair, and I think it's very cool that they have enough runway to keep going, like you said.
Like, I think that it goes back to our conversation last week on Magic Leap around these valuations. And it's a really weird thing to look at, basically. You know, they don't really matter that much, and it depends on how long, you know, the founders and the partners, the investment partners, see the company over, you know, like, and where they expect to land it in the end. Where is this company going to land? And I think, you know, that's a very reasonable valuation for everyone to make their money back and sell the company into somewhere. Absolutely. Like Google or Microsoft or something like that.
Man, that would actually be pretty cool if that actually happened. Giphy integration in Google. I would be all about that.
Oh, I love it.
Oh man, I need GIF search engine in Google. Even though, I mean, it technically does that, but Google Images is disappointing comparatively. So we got to jump right into the deep end now and talk about something crazy that happened this week. So Apple got ordered by the, I guess, was it Supreme Court or High Court? I don't know. They got ordered by basically the FBI to unlock the phone that was involved in this. I can never say the name. San Bernardino. Okay. So the FBI ordered Apple to unlock the phone involved in the shootings a few weeks ago. And so Apple kind of published this public letter saying, well, we're not going to do that. If we do that, it's a slippery slope. They didn't say that we can't do it. They just said that we won't. And it's really interesting because not only are they resisting a court order to unlock something, they are trying to avoid setting precedent for the future, because the FBI is kind of saying this like crazy, oh yeah, but just make it for this one phone. Don't even worry. It's just one device. We can't do that again. But I guess Tim Cook made this public letter and he said, yes, but if we do it once, it sets a precedent for us to do it again and again and again. And then we have this potentially permanent backdoor. Debate has been fierce.
So I think one of the most important things on this debate is that first and foremost, obviously everything that happened was terrible. And, you know, 14 people were killed and 22 people were seriously injured. And there is absolutely no doubt with equivocation that it was a terrorist attack on the United States and on home soil. And that is awful. And it's really, really difficult for people to, I don't necessarily think put that aside is the right way to phrase it, but to look past the fact that this was a terrorist attack and see that this case is a very easy case for the FBI to kind of lay down this precedent on being able to have the courts order technology companies to create software that they do not currently have in order to circumvent security measures within their own devices and within their own products. And I think that in terms of the precedent, it's not just the precedent that it sets on, and I think a lot of people are looking at the precedent very simplistically. It's not just the precedent that it sets on, look, they might be able to come back and ask to have this done again. It's that it sets a bar for what the court considers reasonable technical assistance to the United States on behalf of technology companies. And we can't come back from that.
Yes.
So if they say, absolutely, okay, the last bar was that you had to write a custom iOS build to, you know, flash onto the phone using MemRAM or RAM or whatever, and then access an encrypted component, the next court order could be, you know, requiring them to write a piece of software that sits in between iMessage and their servers and records everything. And the next thing might be, and I think it is really important for everyone, and I think also to really be aware of the fact that these devices aren't just sold in the United States. The jurisdiction that is kind of responsible for this in the United States has a larger obligation to the fact that these devices are sold across the whole world, and many people in many different jurisdictions have them.
Yeah, so that's the thing is, so not only is Apple going to fight on this front, so even if they say they win this battle, I think this is going to start, they're going to see similar battles worldwide. And so it's really interesting that this is happening right now, because it kind of looks like the FBI is leveraging this as a way. I mean, the encryption debate is very active right now. We're kind of in the crux of it. And I think they're using this as a really good example of why they need to be able to break strong encryption. So it's really interesting from that perspective. And then you have this other two-faced thing going on at the moment. So I was reading this Reuters article today. It's from last year, but it's a piece that basically says Barack Obama, he went on the TV and he criticized China for these new rules that requires backdoors in all their software. And you're like, wait a minute, you're literally asking a US tech company to do that right now, but you're begging China not to do it. It's like this weird double standard. And it's the same for European countries. If this backdoor is built in for the US, they are going to want to access it to it, or the European Union might go the other way and say, well, we don't want these products with backdoors in them. So it's dangerous. I'm worried. I think it's going to be an interesting few weeks to see, I guess.
Yeah, I think that this is going to go to the Supreme Court, and ultimately the Supreme Court is in a lot of flux anyway. Who knows if it's going to be hearing cases this year, given the death of Supreme Court Justice, the recent Supreme Court Justice death. But so regardless, I doubt this will be settled this year. And I doubt that Apple will be complied to do this year, because ultimately this was done by a lower court judge in a state judge. And so it's got to work its way all the way up through the circuit.
It's going to be long.
It's going to be a long, long road anyway. And I think it's really important that there is a lot of thoughtful debate around this issue. And it's really difficult to have thoughtful debate around the issue when there's a lot of emotions tied to the issue. And so that's absolutely why the terrorist thing is kind of what makes it, you know, emotionally charged and difficult. And I think we need to generally, both as, you know, commentators and the press and people who, you know, think about this, really need to be very mindful of how emotional we allow ourselves to get around an issue that sets precedent forever. And really impacts the U.S. Constitution in a very, very serious way. I mean, what they are asking for is technically unconstitutional.
Yeah, it's really interesting, I guess, if you look at it, they're kind of trying to sell it as, oh, yes, but it's, on Twitter and discussions in the media, you're seeing people sell it as, oh, but it's just one iPhone and it's just the iPhone 5C. Don't worry about it. The iPhone 5S has a secure element, so they can't do it if they do it for that. But it's really about more than that, I think.
All irrelevant. Yep. Yeah, it's all irrelevant. Exactly. That's all irrelevant.
I think the fact that it's an iPhone 5C is just, the FBI is incredibly lucky in that regard that they have a phone that they might be able to access. Because if it was a 5S, they would be out of luck. And that's what's really adding more heat to the argument as well, is, oh, yeah, but don't worry about it. So I agree that is irrelevant. I think this is going to be ongoing.
Because the thing about the C versus the S or whatever is that this, using the all writs component of the law that she's using, the precedent then becomes around reasonable technical assistance, basically, to technology companies, to the government. Right. And I think that's the component that I'm most concerned about, that if reasonable technical assistance is writing a new version of iOS and flashing it onto a device, what is reasonable technical assistance when they require access to you know, an iPhone 6S or something like that? And to compel Apple to say, we are going to pay, like they've said in the court order, they're willing to pay for it. They might be as willing to go as far as, we're going to pay $10 million for you to rewrite. We're going to order you to let us pay you $10 million to have you rewrite a new version of iOS, iOS, whatever one we're on now, 6, I guess, that, you know, doesn't have your keys attached to it, or has a rotated key, or has a master key that can, you know, decrypt the drive. And I just think, who knows where this can go? And frankly, it's really just about having the conversation as public. I mean, if the vast majority of people want the opposite, then, you know, that's a conversation that has to be had too. I mean, we in technology, yeah, appreciate one side of it. And I think it's really important for journalists. And I think it's really important for business people keeping trade secrets. And just generally, you know, I think it's good that Apple thinks about encryption and privacy in the right way. But you know, we may have people say, actually, you know, we trust the government and we want them to be able to have some kind of access to, you know, some oversight and some kind of access. Unfortunately, with the Patriot Act and 9/11, we can't trust them. And it's a shame, because, you know, if they had have acted in good faith and they hadn't have hidden what is an extraordinarily large surveillance program from everyone effectively, then maybe it would have been a different conversation. But to date, it hasn't been that.
Yeah, it's definitely right. I think that the climate is very untrusting of really, like, how far will they go beyond this? So it's really interesting in that regard. I also think that it'll be interesting to see how far Apple is willing to go with this before. I mean, I don't know how far they'd be able to go before the board or shareholders can start saying, whoa, 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 guys. So I don't know if you have any insights into that, but it would be...
Yeah, I spoke to some people from Apple, and I don't know, it seems like he has pretty much full support. My understanding is that they're not going to go to jail for this, but that it's going to go to the Supreme Court. Like, that's where they're going to take it, to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court's in an interesting state right now. So it's going to be, I don't think this is going to get resolved in the next 18 months.
Yeah, so that's my other question, is we also have this kind of like US election that's going on, and the candidates have been very contrasting. On one side, you've got these candidates saying, I think we need to break encryption. And then actually, have we even had any candidates that have come out in support of strong encryption? I don't think I've seen any.
Yeah, only Bernie Sanders has. Hillary Clinton and all of the Republicans have sided with the government. And Bernie Sanders has said that civil liberties and privacy trump all else. The Constitution trumps all.
Right. So that's, I mean, that's an interesting thing in itself. Not only is this case going to kind of end up spanning presidencies, it could change a lot, right, in the 18-month period when somebody else is in power. So it's going to be interesting to watch. I think we're going to end up talking about it a lot more. It is unprecedented to see Apple kind of making these public open letters already.
I think it's really important. I think that they're doing what they need to do, and I think it's really important that they inform the public. Look, I worked for a cloud hosting provider, the second largest cloud hosting provider in the world, as the VP of strategy. I am very, very well aware of what the government does and what the government asks for. And it never made me comfortable. I pretty much can't go any further than that legally and saying it without being arrested, but it never made me comfortable. It still doesn't make me comfortable. This doesn't make me comfortable, and it shouldn't make anyone else comfortable either.
Absolutely. So I'm sure we'll talk about this a lot more. We've got actually one more security topic to talk about. Do you want to tell us about what's going on with this hospital?
Yeah, so this is really crazy. I actually don't know what to think about this. So a hospital in Hollywood had its systems commandeered via a bad actor and malware installed on their
ransomware
machines, which allowed them to basically take control of the systems, shut everything down, encrypt and lock out patient records, and basically grind the whole hospital to a stop, and demanded $17,000 worth of Bitcoin
of course
to pay it back. And the hospital complied. They paid the terrorists.
Insane. It's insane. And it's crazy how commonplace this is actually kind of starting to become as well. It's like there's these dysfunctional... So I don't know if... Did you read the one from last year? So there was a sheriff's department. I think this is like the most famous one that paid some... And it was more than this, I'm pretty sure. It was some inordinate amount of money, like $50,000 or something, to unlock all of their computers because they lost everything. They didn't have backups, and it was just all ransomed. So it's kind of interesting that it's actually happening in the public sector as well.
Wow.
Like, and it's...
I mean, it's scary.
It's unprecedented, right? Like, this is not a thing that's really happened in the past. It's not even just disruptive. Like, you have viruses which destroy everything, and you're like, oh, shit. Okay, well, I guess we'll rebuild or come back from backups. But ransomware is way more devastating because, A, everything is still there, and they can promise you that you'll get it back if you pay. And B, they probably ransom your backup files as well. So it's you're in a no-win game, and it's scary. And I guess the level of security that these public health and other sectors have is probably partially to blame. But holy shit, they paid the money.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, actually? Last week we talked a little bit about startup CEOs running into regulated industries and not really understanding them very well. And a lot of that regulation is in place to protect the public good. But I don't see a lot of regulation in place around, you know, standards required for medical facilities and stuff like that in terms of, you know, there's some there, but... I think there needs to be likely a complete overhaul on how hospitals and public service sector organizations have to deal with this stuff, because frankly, that's completely unacceptable. If your network is at the point where that can happen, you're not doing a very good job.
Well, the other question is, does this stuff often need to be online? Does it need to be perpetually online? Can they not air gap it? Can they not... I'm surprised that they didn't talk about what the attack vector is. I mean, there's a million attack vectors, right? Like, someone could have left a USB stick in the car park with the ransomware on it. But I'm really surprised that it was able to get everything, not even just a few things. Like, I think that's inherently really scary. I'm constantly
paranoid.
Yeah,
they took control of the network.
Things.
It's crazy.
Like, not even on a small scale. And so it's really interesting. I'm sure there's lots more of these cases we don't hear about. I mean, the Sony thing was a similar kind of thing, except they actually leaked the files as well. And we're starting to see a lot more of this kind of corporate espionage, public terrorism on the on systems. So it's scary. I having worked in IT departments before, they're not... In the public sector too, they're not particularly well funded, so it's unclear what the best way to kind of proceed is.
Yeah, I think we need to start looking very seriously at how well, how basically companies are required to implement encryption and microservices and decentralized services. And I think we're just generally not doing a very good job of having the conversation around how all of this stuff works together. And I think this Apple iPhone case is another component of that. The hacked hospital is another component of that. There's some major, major issues in the banking sector right now that I think a lot of people aren't even aware of. Like it's, there's some real, real shit going on. And I don't think that, I think people don't even know the half of it. And I think that's even scary, the scariest part.
Here's an idea. We just put Chromebooks everywhere in the government. They can't get malware, they can't break. We just have to put everything in the cloud somehow, and then there's no malware. Magically we fixed it.
I mean
realistically there's a solution. Put everything online, make the terminals dumb as hell, boom.
Yeah, and I put a lot more confidence in Apple and Google and Microsoft as three companies, and AWS, Amazon, to do a better job of providing these services than anyone else does. And frankly, I can't wait to see what AWS becomes, because I think it has the potential to fix a lot of these problems, right? Once we start outsourcing all of our enterprises in our public sector, our public service organizations to a secure, well thought out cloud infrastructure, and we start thinking about immutable infrastructure and microservices and encryption in a much healthier, better way, then we're in for a better ride. But that conversation is not like even having being happy is not happening as widely as it needs to.
No, not at all. I think it's going to be a long road, but it needs to happen. Like, it's a space that can be disrupted still as well. And I know that there's plenty of startups looking at like these areas, but it just moves so slowly compared to everything else.
Yeah, I think that the Zenefits thing and the Zenefits CEO has really hurt a lot of this stuff moving forward. And I think we need to be really cautious, and we need to be careful as an industry, as a technology industry, of like, we have an obligation to use what we know to make things better for everyone. And running into highly regulated industry with the guise and banner of disruption is silly. You know, it's not how we should think about things. I think adding value is considerably more important than disrupting current value.
Absolutely.
So
it's something to watch. So everybody who's listening, make sure you've got an antivirus or Mac. You know, just get a Mac or a Chromebook to make sure you're safe. That's how it works, right? Yeah, Macs and Chromebooks.
Yep. Macs and Chromebooks.
Actually, there is one thing I want to touch on really quickly. I don't know if you saw the story today about how schools are turning old computers into Chromebooks, but I thought it was the coolest thing ever. So there's this new startup that built a piece of software, basically, and it's a USB key that turns old shitty laptops into Chromebooks. And what it's letting schools in the US do is get their old retired hardware and actually recycle and give it back to kids, especially in areas that can't afford computers, because the Chrome OS runs great on that stuff. So I just kind of wanted to say, like, that's the coolest thing ever, and you should check that out.
I mean, we look, I've been saying since 1997, when we were thinking about DeviantArt and like how there's no reason for things to live locally. It shouldn't have been web pages. It should have been web apps. It shouldn't really be web apps. It should be an OS, and we should just have dumb terminals that connect to an application that's constantly updated in the cloud. And that's a much better world. But getting there, it's kind of contra to what Apple wants. Yep. It's kind of contra to what Microsoft wants. The only people that are pushing it in that direction are Google. And it's hard because even though Google are right, they also have a vested interest in being right.
Yeah, of course. I mean, in their defense, it is working really well. If you look at the Chromebook model, it's kind of interesting how it's really disrupting schools. And I think if Google has the long-term play there, they actually are going to do really well for themselves from the bottom up, right? So, you know, back in the day, it was like iMacs or Windows PCs in schools, but I kid you not, like, every school, it seems like, in New Zealand is using Chromebooks now. And that's a smart way to like infiltrate the minds of the, you know, of the kids that are used to working this way, only on the web. They don't have to mess around with the system. They just start it up and they're online. So it's, in the long term, I think that's a really smart play. Google has to stick with it long term though, right? That's the key. It's really, really long term. Not even just 5 years. We're talking 15, 20 years, you know?
Yep.
It's really interesting. All right. I think that's everything we have time for this week.
I think so.
So this is a Charge Tech Podcast. We hope you enjoy listening. We'd love to hear from you. I am at OW on Twitter and John is...
I'm Jay Edgar on Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week. Whoop.